My name's Charlie Bartell, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Charlie.
God, I'd love to say that. You know, these are open meetings. If someone had wandered in off the street, they would say, and they weren't familiar with our program, there'd be old Maud and Henry that wandered in, and Henry would say to Maud, "My God, did you hear what he said out loud?" And, "Yeah," Maud would say, "and he sounds almost proud of it." Bless his poor heart. It's such a pleasure to be here in Atlanta. God, what a beautiful progressive city. I'm from a third world banana republic, specifically New Orleans. And here on the tops of your skyscrapers, you put crowns and tiaras, and it's obvious that you're proud of the city. We didn't have to go to that expense in New Orleans. We solve our problems in a much cheaper and more practical manner, I think. You know, to your eyes, when you get to New Orleans, you would see things that you generally call litter and trash on the street. We got rid of that problem. We just call that charm. We don't have slums. We have lovely old homes. It solves a myriad of problems doing that. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Jerry and Ron and Dick, you people have treated me like I was somebody, and I appreciate that, you know. That's a new experience, and a wonderful one. All of you have been so nice, and when you ask how you're doing, how you're feeling, can I do something for you, I know that you in the South really mean that, and that your sponsors didn't necessarily tell you to say that, and I appreciate that so much. I love the theme of the conference. It's beautiful. It's one of the few parts of the big book that caught my immediate attention. We absolutely insist on enjoying ourselves. In South Louisiana, we would say it a little differently. We would say, laissez bon temps rouler. That means let the good times roll. Many a time I've started my talk off by saying, je m'appelle Charles Bartel. Je suis alcoolique, a member in good standing of Alcoolique Anonyme. But for the sake of brevity and being Sunday morning, I noticed that Clancy scared part of the crowd off. But wasn't my fault. Here at the San Diego International, Clancy was speaking at the same time I was, and they always list the number of people that the room held. I noticed my room held 900 and his held 4,000, and I was very grateful because I knew that there was a handy place to take my overflow. Low self-esteem has never been a problem with me. Just the opposite. I needed this program when I got here. In fact, they pick a subject for you to speak on, the General Service Office, and I was speaking on humility. They don't always get everything right there, you know? It was a new experience. But I love this program dearly. I love everything about it. I love our old unregistered trademark, the circle and triangle, the circle. I can just see Bill Wilson standing in St. Louis where they first unveiled it. It was at the International in St. Louis in 1955 behind him, and he pointed so proudly to it and said, that circle symbolizes the entire world of Alcoholics Anonymous, the entire fellowship. And that triangle symbolizes the three precious legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. The legacy of recovery with its 12 steps, the legacy of unity with its 12 traditions, and the legacy of service. Later he could add to that with its 12 concepts of worldwide service. And I feel so happy that that was here when I got here. We tend to take so much for granted, but after seeing that wonderful film that Dick and everybody here was responsible for producing, it makes us realize that the pioneers came here swimming blind. And fortunate for us, they got it all right. Well, I'll try to get you out of here in a decent hour and start into... I was born in Dallas, Texas. Actually, a part of Dallas called Highland Park. And for any of you that are familiar with Dallas, that would immediately define me as a snot and a snob, because Highland Park is the area of Dallas. When I was a little boy, I thought everybody had a cook and upstairs maid, downstairs maid, yard staff, someone that drove the car, you know, because that's the way we lived. And I want to tell you, it's not a half bad way of living. You can get used to that. You can get used to that in a real big hurry. And I don't know, from the earliest days, I was a manipulative, self-centered brat. Boy, I played everything I could to my advantage. Another part of that big book that I immediately identified with was The Easier, Softer Way. And I just literally set out to live life that way. I'll give you a rough idea of my age. One of my earliest memories was the first time I saw grown men cry, and I remember it shook me up immensely. It was on December the 7th, 1941. And they were talking about Pearl Harbor, and I thought, well, what's so wrong with that? I knew what pearls were and what a harbor was, and I thought, what a beautiful place that must be. And I just couldn't understand that everybody's world was turning upside down. I went to school and discovered a marvelous thing. I discovered that the first time I went to a preschool, I came home with a little paper, and on that paper was a gold star. And I found that if you show that gold star to adults, they just turned backflips. They got all excited, patted you on the back, and rewarded you in some way, and I thought, well, that's the secret of life. And I set out very purposely to collect gold stars in my life. As I progressed through school, I noticed that getting those gold stars wasn't too hard. I was blessed with a certain ability, and my father had the same ability. He was a wildcatter. He had his PhD from Stanford University. Interesting how he became a wildcatter. His father had been a very successful merchant on the West Coast. Had a string of drug stores called Bartell Drugs. And after he got his PhD in geology, he decided to enjoy life and enjoy the excitement of life. And one of the things he did, at that time, it was very popular to have cross-country road races. And he managed to put together an old car, and it had no rules, and the press would keep up with the progress of these races. It just required that you start with your rear wheels in the Pacific Ocean, and the first one whose front wheels touched the Atlantic Ocean won. And he took the southern route and was dashing across the United States in this automobile, and fortunately for me and my family, he had an accident in Shreveport, Louisiana, and turned his car over. And he wired home for funds. And interestingly enough, he got a return wire, and it said simply, get a job. It was time. And thank God he decided not to get a job. He instead put a group of investors together and wandered into East Texas, and he hit the Hawkins oil field, and for that I'll be eternally grateful. He was a successful wildcatter, and when I came along, by the time I came along, I have one older brother. You know, the type that's easy to develop resentments for. He was just perfect. You know, it's hard to live up to perfection. But my earliest memories were of my father did and mother did a lot of entertaining, and I remember these magic events that would occur usually on the weekend around our house, and it was a thing that they called a cocktail party. And I would notice that everybody would stand around, they'd get a little louder and a little more cheerful, and the laughter would peal out in the rooms, and I thought, this is a secret. But I couldn't drink what they were drinking, and I didn't really understand that. And this obviously was some elixir that only adults could have, but it made a profound early impression on me, the conviviality that existed in these cocktail parties and these associations. Neither of my parents suffered from alcoholism. We get here from a lot of different roads. The beautiful thing about our fellowship is that we find a common solution and walk that common path as we proceed through recovery, the road of happy destiny. But as a child, I never remember my parents ever even raising their voice toward each other. There was no violence, there was nothing but love, and it was an idyllic childhood. I can remember them disagreeing on things, and they would sit down and very rationally discuss it and come to a mutual decision. And that was my model for being an adult. That's hard to live up to when you later become an alcoholic, I'll tell you that. But things were just beautiful. And I met a lot of people that would come through that were the movers and shakers. There was one guy in particular that I used to like in the early 40s that would drop in from time to time, and he always wore khaki outfit and a big old felt fedora hat, and he seemed to be more of a my compadre than associating with the adults. I knew right away that he was in some way a little bit eccentric, and he used to like to take me out in the backyard and play pitch and catch, and we'd play together sometimes for hours, you know, and we might wander off in his car and go get ice cream and things. I just liked him a lot. I later realized who that was when he suddenly started making the news more frequently and went Hollywood on me. His name was Howard Hughes, and Howard Hughes was one of my playmates. You know, it was just an interesting childhood. Going through school, I found that I had an attribute that my father had, and it's called eidetic imagery. And eidetic imagery is a technical term for photographic memory. And so school was fairly easy. If you could just commit these facts down very quickly, you didn't really have to work a lot. But I thought that it was so easy that if I told people I had that ability, that they wouldn't appreciate my gold stars. So I never mentioned it. And I floated through with all A's, you know, and I belonged to all the right clubs and all the right associations. And in high school, I discovered a magic thing. I discovered that occasionally we'd get out and split a six-pack, all the people. Now, I didn't experience the same thing on my first drink that a lot of alcoholics describe from these podia. I didn't immediately find some unique occurrence in my personality when I took that first drink. I didn't feel that warmth that a lot of people describe. I had to do it the old-fashioned way, a drink at a time. But I did have an enormous capacity for it, and I don't recall a time that I ever got sick from drinking. You know, I could just drink and drink and drink, and it was just a wonderful thing. And I graduated from six packs of beer to very sophisticated drinks. I remember my first day, it had to be a sophisticated drink. It had an umbrella in it and some cherries and a slice of orange. And I just thought that was wonderful. And I eventually graduated from high school, and have nothing but warm memories of that. I was fairly popular and got along with everybody, liked girls. I noticed right away in an early age that they certainly at least smelled better than we did, and they were softer, and it was fun to be around them. But it came that time when I had to go to college, and I looked forward to that. It'd be my chance, in my mind, to be an adult and to have all the magic elixir I wanted. And the family got together in one of those kind little discussions round table, and they said, well, we'll send Charles to the University of Oklahoma. It's got the finest petroleum engineering program in the country. My mother was a geologist. My father was a geologist. My older brother by this time was a geologist. They needed a petroleum engineer in the family, so off I was trucked to the University of Oklahoma. That was at the time that Bud Wilkerson was there, for you football fans, and I got there the year that they won the 55th game in a row, still a record. And I settled in and joined the right fraternity and did the right things and started drinking a little more. And 4 years later, I graduated, and they were surprised that I not only had one degree, but I had 2 degrees. But unfortunately, neither one were in petroleum engineering. I decided to major in something much more practical. I got a bachelor's degree in psychology and a bachelor's degree in history. And as you know, this qualified me of one of two things. I could either sell used cars or anything else. But in the process of this, I'd gotten all the gold stars. I'd been inducted into Phi Beta Kappa and all these right things. And after all, I did school well. And so when I graduated, what did I do? Well, I just went to school. I got a master's in psychology, and went to Harvard and got a master's in mathematics because I was interested in math modeling as a theoretical base. There I have two bachelors, two masters, and what do? Well, I went to school. I got a PhD in experimental psychology. Now, all through this time, I'd been publishing a little bit and had some good luck doing it. And I was really interested in research and things like that. I'm sure you're all familiar with my research. I probably have a copy of it handily at home, just in case you want to refer to it, bedside table or something. My master's research, for instance, was on the effect of ionizing radiation on the white rat. I knew you knew. Well, if you don't have that, sure, you have my doctoral dissertation, which was on the perception of geomagnetism in the Belgian homing pigeon. See, I found it was a lot easier to get gold stars if you picked some arcane, minute little subject that you knew more about instantly than any of the members of your committee. So I just chose to specialize in minutia. I swear I'd get on Double Jeopardy, except that it'd probably be rock music of the 70s, and I blacked out in the 70s. I'll tell you another thing alcohol will do for you. It'll pretty well erase eidetic imagery. And it can play mysterious things on you. Well, while I was an undergraduate, I'd fallen in love and had gotten married. As long as I was getting these gold stars, generous checks were coming from home. And by the time I had my PhD, I had two children. A lovely son and a little girl, light of my life. That son today's 42, that girl's 36. And both are very successful in spite of me. I'm very proud of them. And I find myself graduated with a PhD in experimental psychology. But what do? I went to school. It's what I do. And I did rather well. I went to Oxford University and spent a year there doing research with a famous zoologist by the name of Lennon I. Tinbergen. And I was the oddity. They called me a brass instrument scientist, and I would dash around and make operant conditioning equipment and things and make needless bells and whistles, and I enjoyed myself so much in England. I have a soft spot to this day for my experience there, but an interesting thing happened. You see, we live in a culture where we don't have royals and we don't have the privilege of doing nothing. We live in a culture that insists upon making your mark in life and being productive, and I got sort of the proverbial telegram, and it said simply, get a job. The checks from home were going to cease. Well, I added up all my assets and said, well, what can I do? During this whole time, my drinking had progressed and become a regular thing. I was a daily drinker, but I didn't see that it was affecting my behavior, and no one else seemed to notice particularly, not my wife or children. And it just part of my lifestyle. I added up and I found that with all my qualifications, I was once again qualified for two things. I could either sell used cars or I could teach. And teaching has a sort of a panache about it. I'd published over 50 times by then, and that was at the height of Publish and Perish, and that's what universities were looking for. So I sent out vitae's around. Vitae is a PhD talk for resume. And I sent them out to various departments that I thought I could bless them, and it'd be their lucky day they could get me. And from these, I called five places to go interview. And I remember my first interview. It was not far from here. In fact, I flew into Columbus, Georgia, because they didn't have an airport there. It was in Auburn, Alabama, the University of Auburn. And I got down there, and psychologists are weird ducks anyway, and for some reason they decided, well, we're going to take this yo-yo and put him through a stress interview. And I was told to be at the chairman's office at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I showed up promptly at 8. I'd ensconced myself in a local cinder block palace the night before, a motel there not far from the campus, and I'd rented a car in Columbus and went over there, and I got in there, and he said a very strange thing to me. He said, "How did you find us?" And I said, "Well, you're on the map," and the interview started going downhill from there. He'd say, "Well, Dr. Bartell, you're teaching a class in 10 minutes. And I hadn't been told that I was to prepare anything, but it didn't bother me any. We traipsed down the hallway and we walk in, and I realize it's an amphitheater classroom, and the entire faculty and all the graduate students are in there. And they wanted to see how I'd perform under that. Well, I probably gave them more information than they ever wanted to know that hour on the effect of ionizing radiation on bar pressing behavior in the white rat. Went through the whole day like that. I ended up teaching five classes that day, unprepared, cold. I was led into the laboratory and had to demonstrate that I knew how to hook up all the electronic equipment and things. And finally, we met back in the chairman's office, and he said, "The azaleas are in bloom, and our neighborhoods are so lovely." And he said, "Would you like to go out and see the flowers, or would you like to go to my house for a cocktail?" Some choice. Not surprisingly, I opted for the cocktail, and we ended up at the chairman's house, and the whole faculty was there. And they were sitting back, and, you know, we as alcoholics don't generally notice when we're active how other people drink. And I was probably working on my third one by then. And I'd reared back in that chair and was telling them my theoretical positions on emotion and motivation theory and learning theory, and I was just carrying forth, when one of them said a very strange thing to me. He said, "You know, Dr. Bartell, one of the things that we're most proud of here at Auburn is that we do not allow the sale of alcoholic beverage within two blocks of the campus." My response to that was to stand up immediately, tell them goodbye, get in that rental car, and go back to Columbus, Georgia, and take the first available out. Obviously, I couldn't live under such hostile conditions. Totally out of the question. Now, see, alcohol was making major decisions for me, and I didn't see it. I was, by this time, totally delusional and didn't have any idea. Second interview was at the University of Washington in Seattle, and it went sort of well. And then, now this is 1966, mind you. Then my next interview was in California at Berkeley. Now I want to tell you, in 66, Berkeley was happening. And laid back, wow. I seriously considered just staying there, you know. Wire for the kids. But I had two more interviews to make, and the second one was at Southern California. Southern Cal. And I go down there, and I've never seen so much blonde hair and long legs in my life. Jeez. It was tempting, but I had one more, and I'd agreed to interview at all five of these places, so I got in an airplane, and I flew east and landed at an airport called Marzahn Field. Marzahn Field is the name of the airport in New Orleans, Louisiana. I got a cab and I was going into town. And I asked the cab driver, what are the drinking laws here in New Orleans? He was confused by the question. So I had to clarify, and I said, well, when can you drink? When do they close the bars? And he said, whenever they want to. I said, you mean you can buy alcohol 24 hours a day? He says, yeah, 7 days a week. I want to tell you, I'd found civilization. I had an interview the next day at Tulane University, and I got the chairman's department at 11. And we shook hands, and he says, we'll do lunch. At 1 o'clock, I signed a contract to teach at Tulane University. We'd gone to the faculty dining room, and they had carafes of wine on the table. And I said, what's with the wine? He says, that's just a perk. He says, there's no charge for that. I had found, truly, civilization. Major decisions in my life were being made by alcohol, and I didn't see it. Now, I'd like to be able to stand up here and tell you that I had the most successful career teaching at Tulane University. And my research, and what had they really hired? They hired someone that was going to grind out 3 or 4 papers a year, publish, make the department look good. They gave me a light teaching load as an assistant professor, and all my classes were on Tuesday and Thursday, and the rest of the time I was to generate research in the lab. Beautiful lab equipment and things. And I never published another paper. Any investigation I started doing at that time was from bar stool to bar stool. And I'm certainly not proud of that, but I didn't seem to have a choice in matters. I ran amok. I taught there for 3 years, and in December of 1969, I went into the chairman's office and said that my research hadn't been doing well, and he readily agreed. And I suggested that I take a sabbatical and just concentrate on the research that was teaching those few classes that were screwing me up. We'll look any place for an excuse. And he said, well, you haven't been here long enough to have a sabbatical with pay. And I said, I don't want the pay. I just want to use the laboratory equipment. And he readily agreed to my demands. And I walked away out of that department that day. And I never went back. I plunged head on into full-blown alcoholism at that point, still not realizing it. I wasn't hurting anybody. So I thought, I wish I'd have found the rooms right around the corner of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't. I became a daily drinker by 74, I'd lost my wife and children. Interesting how that happened. She walked in, I'd invested in a radio station.
Bayou stereo, all music, all the time.
And she walked in hand one evening with the manager of that station, you know. And I was informed that they were in love. Hell, I had no idea, and they were taking the children and leaving. Now, The only pattern I had to how to react to such news was my parents. I said, wait, let's be adult about this. Let's sit down and talk about it. And I came up with a brilliant plan that what we needed was just a trial separation. Let's not do anything hasty. Let's not take the children out of school. I will move out and get an apartment, and we'll just have a trial separation for a while. And sure enough, the next day I moved out, and the following day at 5 in the morning there was this thundering on the door, and I went down there and met for the first time in my life, not the last, but the first, a process server, and I was charged with desertion of my children. You see, we have a Napoleonic code there, and the only grounds for divorce is adultery or desertion, and I think that she decided to look better having desertion rather than adultery, which she could readily prove, but she didn't go to that trouble. It wasn't my adultery either. And I was furious. I was furious, and I did the only thing that a person could do under those circumstances. I went to Hong Kong. I don't know if it made sense at the time. I told the attorney, my attorney there, I said, look, I said, keep the child support to a minimum. I'll take care of the children. But give her anything she wants in alimony. Because I knew that she wanted to get remarried right away. Besides, alimony's deductible. Hey, I might have been delusional, but I wasn't dumb. Alimony was deductible and child support was not. And so I spent 6 months in Hong Kong. And when I returned home and checked in with the attorney, he said, the divorce is on schedule, and I want you to know that your alimony is zero. And he was patting himself on the back. And he said, and your child support's $1,000 per child, $2,000. Now, that was a lot in the 70s for child support. But I bit the bullet and paid the child support. I remember the last payment I made after my daughter was a month away from turning 18. And I wrote out a check for $1,000 and handed it to my ex. And she says, look, you've been superb about the child support. She said, I just can't take this last check. I thought, aha, being tricky. She will have the right to tell everybody, that son of a gun never paid all his child support. And I forced it on her, feeling very good about it. And she wandered out. And my daughter looked up at me and said, Dad, you know we've been living with you for 5 years. I don't think you really had to pay any of that child. Oh! Well, I tell you, turns out I was a major support for my husband-in-law. He'd managed to lose his job and take up gambling. I don't know whether he's in another 12-step program or not, but he needs to be. And that's sort of the way my life went. At the height of my drinking, hell, I thought I was a jet setter. You see, along the way, my father had passed away and my mother had passed away, and I was left with the ability to do pretty much what any spoiled child would want. I could solve any whim I had instantly. At the height of my drinking, I was maintaining a residence in London, one in Hong Kong, one in San Francisco, and one in Manhattan, and my home in New Orleans. Not a half bad way to live, but very difficult in a blackout keeping up with everything. But I had solved that problem. I'd hired what later these wonderful counselors informed me were enablers. I thought they were executive assistants and things, you know. People pat me on the back. Mainly their job was to load me on and off of airplanes, you know. I never got a DWI. Too drunk to start a car. The attorneys informed me that because of my lifestyle, I should never get behind the wheel of an automobile, and if I did, someone would own me. You know, they might just pull out in front of me on purpose or something. And so I always had a driver. And occasionally I'd slip off with a car, though. I remember I discovered early, if I went down to the quarter in New Orleans or someplace, I'd always park in a commercial garage. And if any of you are thinking about relapsing, you just take that as an advice. You never lose a car that way, because you can reach in your pocket the next day and you can have the address of where your car is. Simplifies things.
Yeah.
Go pick up your car. I remember I did that one day. I would crash in hotels all over town for the night, you know. I'd wake up in a hotel and I'd reach in my pocket and I'd find my receipt and go my merry way. I was confused. I was walking down Royal Street and I couldn't find my car. And I went to this bar called Sloppy Jim's, and I went up to the bartender and I said, John, I can't find my car. Can you help me? And I gave it to him. He looked at it and nodded his head. And I said, you know where it is? He says, yeah. I said, where is it? And he said, San Francisco. Oh. Things happen to drunks. It's just unexplainable. Gosh. I drank like that for 20 years. I didn't find this program. I'm a newcomer. I drank until I could no longer get on and off those airplanes. I drank until even my neighbors, no matter how much I paid them, became so disgusted they left me. I drank until my children wouldn't come to see me. I had one maid that stuck out to the bitter end, but she doesn't speak English, so that helped. She's from Brazil, still with me, Maria. And the last 2 years of my drinking, it wasn't fun, it was have to. Now, if I had to go to a bank and sign something or something, I would pace myself and I could get by on a quart that day. And that was like not drinking. But if I'd really turn it loose, I would drink about 2 quarts a day on average. And I drank like that for 20 years, and that will affect your health. The last year of my drinking, I'd come down with it's a Raynaud's disease. It's called actomycosis. It's a disease caused by filth. And I only have one lung today because of that. It invaded one of my lungs. It's a type of fungus that grows in most of our mouths, but stomach acid kills it, fortunately, so no one ever gets it. But if you ever aspirate, you breathe part of that down your lung, it can spread. And I was on penicillin drip for 6 weeks. I was getting 10 million units every 4 hours. I mentioned casually to my physician, bless her heart, she lives next door to me, I said, well, at least if I've got it, this will cure the clap. And she says, hell, Charles, that'll cure the applause. I didn't find that very comforting. My last year of drinking, I could no longer get out even to a neighborhood bar that wasn't far from there. I used to own bars, and the Mousetrap's a fine place. By God, the Mousetrap. I mean, that was near the Seven Seas. I had a bar down the quarter called The Huddle. God, what a place. You've been to The Huddle, haven't you? She talked about the Bastille. If you're really in, you can have dinner in the steak pit and walk to the kitchen to the Bastille, you know, on the next block. But I was so rudely interrupted. The last about 6 months of my drinking, I made a disastrous decision. Food would be prepared for me, or I would order it, but it was unpalatable. I didn't want food. And I'd make the pretense of eating. I'd stir the plate or something. I was living exclusively on empty calories. I didn't essentially eat for 6 months, but I was ingesting probably 14,000 empty calories a day in the form of alcohol, which is converted to useless sugar in your system. Your liver is fighting it, and one of the things when you reach that stage of drinking, you become so upset, your liver becomes so obsessed with digesting alcohol, it won't digest anything else anyway. It won't even process vitamins, because alcohol is a deadly poison to it. It's trying to preserve life. That led to my last drink. It was December the 5th, 1987. And I woke up. And in those times, you don't have regular sleep patterns. And it was sort of hazy outside, sort of twilight-ish. And I looked at the clock, and it said 7. And I didn't know whether it was a.m. or p.m. And I realized, well, I need a drink. And I started to get out of bed, and I couldn't. And I noticed that I had no feeling from my waist down. and that I was paralyzed. Then I noticed my breathing was labored, and I realized I was consciously counting on each breath. And once again, all those years of study, and well, I used to teach physiology while I was at Tulane. Show you how delusional you can get. I got a letter from Oslo, Norway, and they wanted a copy of my research on the perception of geomagnetism in Belgian homing pigeons. In effect, I'd discovered a new sense in migratory fowl, and this was from the Nobel Prize Committee, if that didn't go to my head. They had asked for this, and to be nominated for the prize, it can be suggested by any previous winner. Have a look at this research, and that's all it said in the letter. I, of course, immediately sat down and started writing my acceptance speech. I'm still waiting for the prize. But that's how delusional we'll become. I woke up that morning and I panicked, not because I realized my sympathetic nervous system was shutting down, but because I couldn't move and I couldn't get to a drink of alcohol. I was obsessed with that idea. I've got to get to a drink. I'm dying and I don't want to die without a drink. The dying, then, that wasn't frightening. In fact, I welcomed it. It was the first time a solution had been presented. I'd never thought of suicide. But here I had my answer. I remember looking back to that bedside table, and there was a half a glass of Jack Daniels. Always been an optimist. It wasn't half empty, it was half full. I reached over and I took that glass, and I fastidiously removed the cigarette butt. I've always been a neatnik. It went to my lips and it went down and it felt right. And then the panic sat in again. I couldn't get to a drink. About 7:45, I heard a commotion at the back door. And I said, "Great, it's morning." And I realized it was Maria coming in to the house. Housekeeper, and I thought, she can get a bottle for me. I'm pitiful and call out in a rail thin voice, "Help!" I waited until she came into the bedroom eventually, and she said, "Oh, you're still in bed." And I heard myself saying, "Yes, sir, I don't have anything to do today, so I've decided to stay in bed today, and can you get me 2 bottles of Jack Daniels, please?" And she said, "Okay," and left the room. Now, what I was calculating on, I thought a half of one would be enough to finish me off and kill me. But happiness is a backup. So I was going to get 2. And I'm waiting rather impatiently, and the time goes by, and time goes by, and it's about 20 minutes, and she finally comes back in and sets 2 bottles of Jack Daniels on that thing, and I realize they're both sealed, and I'm worried about having the strength of opening it. And I said, "Well, I'll just wait till she leaves and I'll crack one of the necks and just drink out of it that way." And I hear an additional noise, and suddenly my children appear. I'm not putting 2 and 2. What a coincidence. And my son talks to me in a way that he'd never talked to me before. I couldn't get over his insolence. He said, "Get out of bed. We're taking you to the hospital." And I said, "What for?" And then he said those words. He says, "We think you have a problem with alcohol." How dare he? I got 2 bottles right there. I've got no problem, no. December the 5th, 1987 was Friday, and I said, "The doctors won't be in on Friday. I promise you on my mother's grave I'll go Monday morning first thing." I didn't have any trouble with that promise. I was going to be dead within 6 hours. I knew it for a fact. My nervous system was shutting down. And he said, "You don't have an option in this. We're taking you." And he told my daughter, he said, "Pack him a bag." He says, "Get out of bed and I started crying. For two reasons. I believe that pride kills more of us than anything else. I had wet the bed, and I didn't want my children to see that. And I started crying, and I never cried in front of my children before. And I said, I can't get out of bed. My legs won't work. And he came around, and he jerked back the cover, and he picked me up like a rag doll. Effortlessly. I was just shocked at his strength. And I was rudely removed from my home and thrown into the back of a car. Next thing I know, we're in a hospital. And hospitals have rules and regulations. And they're checking my blood pressure. And they got to weigh me, and I can't stand on a scale. And so they bring this gadget into the room and put me in this sling, and they're cranking me up. Later I find out they borrowed that from the morgue. That's what they weigh bodies with. How appropriate. And of course, before you can really get admitted, they have to do the really important thing. They have to check your credit. And the nurse called out my weight and said, 105. And I said, that's ridiculous. I've weighed 175 to 180 all my life since I graduated from high school. Again, 105. I was aware that I might have lost a little weight, you know. I'd look in that mirror, but I can understand people with bulimia, anorexia, generally. It didn't appear to be that much. I always thought, well, if I eat Saturday, it'll all come back. You know, that's all I'll eat Saturday. And then I can remember being sort of hazy, and I woke up in the hospital room. There was a nurse in there, and I looked around, and I was very pleased. Private room, of course. And the nurse said, oh, you're awake. I'll go get your doctor. And she ran out of it. Gee. And the doctor came back in and said, Charles, I'm glad to see you awake. We're going to transport you to a rehabilitation center for alcoholics. And I had a moment of clarity. I saw in my mind two bottles of sealed Jack Daniels on my nightstand. And I desperately had to get to them. I said, oh, that won't be necessary. Now, I knew about antabuse. I said, why don't you just prescribe me antabuse and I won't drink anymore. I had to get to those two bottles. She says, no, I've talked it over with your children and we're pretty set on this. We don't think you have a choice in the matter. We're getting ready to transport you. And I said, well, at least why don't you let me spend the night, have a night's rest. And she says, oh, really? How long have you been here? And I said, about 4 or 5 hours, she says, you've been here 10 days. Whoop, took a little wind out of my sail. That's hard to make a forceful argument at that point. So I decide, let him transport me. Well, I'll go down there and escape from that place. So they transport me. Apparently, IV-wise, I've been in detox 10 days. Effectively. I'm going into this thing that they called a treatment center. My only knowledge of that was that they were like whores. They were always on television, you know. And for some peculiar reason, I'd watch those ads. It seemed to have some relationship to them, but I'd go in great style. It was like being carried in on a sedan chair. I'd go in on a stretcher and enter this mysterious process called detox. And cheerful faces would sometimes pop in and say hello. And I'm in detox 7 days. I'm in detox 14 days. I'm in detox 21 days. I notice other people seem to come for a couple of days and leave. I must be getting set for another gold star or something. I must be a prize client. What I didn't know is that my life signs were all over the place and they thought I was dying and they didn't want me there. They wanted to ship me back to the other hospital who didn't want to accept me back as a patient. You see, it's very poor form to die in a hospital. It looks bad on their records and things. I just wasn't wanted, you know. And eventually they sort of gave up on my life science. They never told me. If they told me, I'd have conveniently died for them. This place was boring. But I'd made some progress. I was in a wheelchair. I was mobile. I was plotting escape. Now, the elevator was 70 feet from this detox room, and I was already up to 6 feet in that dang thing before I'd fall over in exhaustion. I'd been working on it. They rolled me down this long corridor. Detox had given up. They said, we'll just send him to group. I went into this room and was introduced to a thing called a counselor. Now, I'm going before a guy with an associate degree at best. I got 5 degrees through a PhD. I had a chip on my shoulder that big. And sure enough, he's an ex-middle linebacker for a professional football team. And he invented the word black. I'm thinking to myself, boy, I hope he's got a sense of humor. Sure enough, he was tricky. The first thing he said is, how would you describe your drinking? And I assured him that I perhaps could be considered a heavy social drinker. To which he replied, well, how much do you drink a day? I thought, ha-ha, he's trying to trap me. And I think if I tell him the truth, he's probably so narrow-minded, he'll think I'm an alcoholic of all things. So I thought about what I used as maintenance, a quart a day for maintenance. If I had to go to the bank or something, spaced out during the day, no effect on me. But that, I said, he's so narrow-minded, he might think a quart a day is too much. Can you imagine? So I said, only about 2 pints a day. Sounded like less to me. And sure enough, he was there. He allowed that I had a problem with alcohol, he thought, in his considered opinion. I almost dropped the Nobel Prize on him right there, but I thought better of it. I entered this magical process called group. Now, I've been in treatment then, 21 days in their detox, 10 days in another detox. I had 31 days, right? I spent 57 days in group. And they were working these mysterious things called steps. They'd do a step 1, 2, and 3. And they'd work on this fourth step and the third step. And the first step, they'd have you write out this biography and everything. And I was pretty good at fiction, so I thought I could handle that, but they never asked me to. I later found out he had drawn the short straw and got the psychologist. And they just kept parking me in the corner. Plus, they had another ulterior motive, I think. You know, there are a lot of good treatment centers. Most of them existed prior to the great rush of treatment centers, and they'd gone under the guise of halfway houses and the like. But there were a lot of very mercenary things that were started in the early 80s and mid 80s. Most of them, by golly, with the change in insurance regulations, are off doing other work now, other good works. But my whole time in there ran a certain pattern. Every Friday I would go, be pushed up to the head guru, and he'd always say the same thing. Charles, we're just so pleased with your progress. You're just making remarkable progress. However, we think that you can profit from another week. Stay with us. And by the way, you owe $9,304, $8,700, and one time it was as much as $11,000 each week. And I'd write him a check. No wonder I was 57 days in group alone. But they just milked me for a lot. I did gain 2 things from them. They had a physical therapy department on another floor. I have an extreme form of peripheral neuropathy. I still can't feel my feet. I walk very slew-footed. They taught me to do that so I don't fall. I have real trouble with steps and escalators, but I've learned to do these things. Most people don't know. They just think I'm 80 years old the way I move. You know, I can handle that. They taught me many things in that, when y'all were having your free time, I was down there lifting enormous 2-pound weights and things. And they were putting me into shape, and the physical therapist did wonderful things for me and taught me a new way of living that worked for me. Another thing they did, they introduced me to the warmest, fuzziest people. They were actually a cult, and it was called Alcoholics Anonymous. These people would be just so incessantly cheerful, you know. I knew they meant well, you know, so I tolerated them. You'll be happy to know. Now, you see, they had these window shades in there, and they had things on it called the steps and the traditions, and I read the steps, and it seemed that every other word was God. And like a lot of newcomers, I had problems with that, but I had exceptional problems. The thing that I didn't mention about my parents were, my parents were militant atheists. A couple of geologists that, my father would sit me down and explain to me that religion was for the unlearned, that they were superstitious and they had to have some simple explanation for creation, and they chose to believe in a magical being. And so that was fine, don't get in any arguments about it, but we live in a cause and effect environment, and everything can be expressed with simple cause and effect relationships. And that God was nothing more than an intervening variable. And he says eventually it'll be expressed in a master equation, and that you will be looking into the face of God at that time. I think I personally was an agnostic. It was irrelevant to me. I could say God and have no emotional response to it. It just wasn't inbred into me. I had no fear one way or the other. It just didn't seem to be important. When I saw God in those characteristics, I just thought, well, they need that sort of concept, but I do not need it, so it's not for me. I remember one time I went to a Methodist thing that some of my teenage friends belonged to, but I went because they had girls and food. It was called MYF, I recall. My parents found out about it and grounded me for 3 weeks. How dare you go to church? It was just a different way of coming up. Yeah. I respected my parents for that, you know, and they had the right to that opinion and things. But so I respected what you folks had, but you don't understand. It doesn't fit into my thing. And I would hear these things, and you'd say, well, it's a spiritual program. It's not a religious program. I said, yeah. Another thing that in order to get out of this treatment center, you had to have a sponsor. And these strange AAers would come bouncing in twice a week. And they would do this thing called sharing, and they would share their story with us. And I just loved them. You know, they'd get so enthusiastic and everything. One came through, and he had a master's degree from Harvard, and I identified with him. He might be just good enough for me. And I asked him for all the wrong reasons to sponsor me, and for all the right reasons, he said yes. And his name was Sky. Finally came that time when a substance abuse technician came up to me and said, Charlie, you want to be here the rest of your life? And I says, no, I've got 2 bottles of Jack Daniels at home waiting on me. Told him the truth. He said, as long as you keep writing those checks, you'll be here the rest of your life. So the next Friday, sure enough, I went up before the guru, and he said, we're just so pleased with your progress. And by the way, you owe such and such. And I sat there and said, I'd love to write you a check, but I'm absolutely broke. The check wouldn't be any good. The next morning, I got my final gold star. Even though I hadn't worked a step, they knew that I was exceptional. And I graduated with high honors once again. Suited me fine. I'd lost my suitcase and some of my belongings by that time, but I had a black garbage bag, and I was packing valuable things in it. I had a urinal. I had a plastic wash basin. I had all these, and they were yellow. I remember that. And I was packing them up. Don't laugh. Those damn things cost $79,000. I was taking them home. I was taking them home. They have this little ceremony and hand me this little medallion. They call it a chip. I was going to get a taxi and find those two bottles of Jack Daniels, and who showed up but Sky? No sense of humor at all, Sky had none. He gave me the true first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, simply get in the car. Started out at 10 o'clock that morning, found myself at an 11 o'clock meeting. Then he took me by this mysterious place that he was awfully proud of. It was called a central office, and he explains to me about service and things, and he's just carrying on. Next thing I know, it's 8 o'clock at night, and we're at a meeting. I hadn't even been home. And I'm tired, Josh, you know, they got me on this chair, and I'm just physically beat. I'm a wreck. I just learned to walk again, you know. Finally, about 10 o'clock after coffee at Shoney's, guy says, well, I'd like to go see where you live now. So I took him by the house, and I said, well, I just won't take him into the bedroom because of the two bottles of Jack Daniels. He's probably as narrow-minded as that counselor about that sort of thing. Walked in, and he walked around and everything and looked at it and said, well, I'll leave you here for the night. I said, fine. And I go into my bedroom. I'd been robbed. They weren't there. I knew that I couldn't stay sober, you know. Actually, by this time, you know, I had 2 months of sobriety. I had 2 months of being dry. I went into my main family room, and I found it necessary to have a bar constructed in there. Actually, the family room was sort of a space around the bar, and three kegs. I had it all in there. Even the kegs were gone. Although the TVs and VCRs and everything were still present, obviously whoever had hit the house owned a bar. Because everything there was to drink was gone. And I was so tired, I couldn't make it out for a bottle. It was my impulse to do it, and I said, well, I'll just do it first thing in the morning. And I slept the sleep of the dead that night. And all of a sudden, I hear a doorbell. It's 7 in the morning. I get up and get to the bar, and I go out, and it's Sky. Get dressed, get in the car. I get a 3-month chip. A month later, Sky's been there the whole time. He must have noticed some recalcitrance on my part or something. And he literally shepherded me through 5 months of sobriety like that. He gave me jobs to do. I remember one day he really insulted me. He had a way of doing that. He was a good sponsor. He said, you consider yourself some kind of damn scientist. He says, write me a paper on ashtrays. I said, I'll show him. I went to the public and two university libraries. I presented him with a 37-page paper on ashtrays, the history of ashtrays, the advantages of glass, pot metal, aluminium, various plastics. I had it down to a science. And I handed it to him. I remember there were 18 sources in the bibliography. Sky looked at that, threw it in the back seat, and says, now buy 12 of the best. The group needs them. Gee. I managed to get out and buy an expert's opinion on 12 of the finest ashtrays he'd ever. I overdid it. I got hand-blown Venetian glass, by God. You'll be happy to know that some AA groups are living right. I get in the car to go to that meeting that night, and I said, I can't wait to show them. There he is, and he says, you can't do that. He says, you know where they keep the ashtrays? And I says, yeah. He says, you've got to slip them in there and don't let anybody see them.
and you can never tell anybody that you bought these ashtrays. And I said, well, what's the point? I really didn't know. And he started talking to me about humility and of true service and of giving without thought of anything in return. Obviously alien concepts to me. But there was something about Sky that I knew that inevitably I was going to drink. I'd racked up 5 months. And I thought, well, how much longer can... And it dawned on me, I'm building a little insurance. It might not be 6 hours. Maybe I can get through 2 whole bottles and start a third before I die. But I knew it would kill me, beyond a shadow of a doubt. And it was still the clear-cut solution for me. Because bless your heart, you told me I could make the table. I had to pick a higher power. Oh, as far as I was concerned, I'd rip through 9 steps. You know, they were like merit badges. Seemed to be important. I thought I was working the steps. I understood that you as a group could pick up a heavy table, and I couldn't even budget. You were more powerful. I could buy that. But somehow I felt gypped. Now I'm gone. I mean, you had this power that could raise the dead. You had a power that could move mountains and create life. And I had you. I was gypped, as far as I was concerned. I didn't realize what you meant with God speaks through you. I couldn't see it. I was so superficial and had no idea. That leads me down to 5 months of sobriety. I go to a meeting that night, and it was a discussion meeting. This guy took me. That day I had to reward myself. The only thing I could understand was that little booklet, Living Sober. He said, you have to change yourself. So I was making superficial changes. I'd always been Charles. I became Charlie. So, big change. I never liked General Motors cars. That day they didn't have a 5-month chip, so I rewarded myself by buying a white Cadillac. You know? And doing these things. I got to that discussion meeting, and they were moderating that night, and the subject was the higher power. I don't know whether you religious freaks can hear yourself, but it's just very upsetting to a person that's sensible and and sensitive as I. I would hear John over there say, my higher power, whom I choose to call God. Haven't you heard that expression? Like if you call it anything else, you're some kind of ninny. No. Then Mary would say, my higher power, whom I choose to call Jesus. And I'd think, God, that's getting awfully specific. It came time for me to share, and I was a master at sharing, and I knew it was important to you folks. You see, with the Siddhetic imagery, among other things, I'd dash through AA Comes of Age, Bill Wilson's Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I'd give you a paragraph each time out of each one of them, you know. And I knew you'd appreciate it because you'd say, well, Charlie, just keep coming back. I speak French, German, and English. Apparently I didn't speak AA, though. It got to me, and they called on me and asked if I would like to share, and I said no. I was incensed with this. And went on around the room. Went out afterwards, and I always loved the meetings after the meetings. I do coffee and pie well, and that sort of made sense to me. I said, Charlie, we're going over to Denny's and have some coffee and a little get-together. Why don't you join us? And I said, I'm a little tired. I hadn't eaten that day, and I'd been force-feeding myself Ensure Plus, and you'd be happy to know I've ballooned up to 145 now. When you digest all your fatty tissue, you start digesting internal organs. I've done a number on my heart and muscle tissue as well. And the doctors figure 145 is about my ideal weight. And put anything on more on, I'll tax my heart and everything. It just makes me resentful. I took such good care of myself, too. Only thing that's done damage is the hair. I look for it to fall out day after tomorrow. But I often lose my place like this. Lose my train of thought. But I said, no, I don't think I will. And so I got in that Cadillac. started it up, and I thought to myself, 5 months, hadn't had a drink, I owe myself a bit of a treat. I wasn't thinking of taking a drink at all. I said, I'll go across the river, I'll go to the French Quarter and go to a real nice restaurant, and it's a late town anyway, you know. I'll go kick back and have a real fine meal and relax, and come back home. This meeting met on the West Bank in part of a town called Algiers, and I had to go around to the Greater Mississippi River Bridge, and at the time it was just the one old bridge. It was trying to absorb about 240,000 cars a day. Always a jam there. I drove around, it was about 9:15, and I drove up the ramp and there was no traffic. It was the strangest thing. I started up, and you know how Chamber of Commerce are, even New Orleans gets proud of itself sometimes. This is the longest, tallest, double cantilevered bridge in the world, for all that means. I'm up about 200 yards on the upslope, and it stands about 25 stories over the Mississippi River there, so aircraft carriers can pass under it. And just clear as a bell, I hear a loud booming voice, and that voice says, 49. And I say, what are the bridge police behind me calling out 49 for over their loudspeaker? And I look in the rearview mirror, there's nothing there. Road's clear. And I drive on a little bit further, and I hear the voice again, not as loud, and it says, 49. And I realize I'm having an auditory hallucination. Mm-hmm. What's the relevance of 49? It didn't make sense. Cold sweat broke out on my forehead. And I wasn't frightened. I was excited by it. But I thought if you'd have an auditory hallucination, if you were going crazy, it'd be something more interesting than a number. I took the first available ramp off, and that's Camp Street. Very symbolic. It's the street of the winos. I'm heading down Camp Street, and I notice an excitement in the air, and I started noticing the neon. And it was brighter than I've ever seen it. It was just, the only way I can describe it is a brilliant neon blue. I'm going down, and I'm excited, and I look up ahead of me, and I'm thinking, you know, if I go to Antoine's or someplace like that, I'll have to tip an exorbitant amount, and I'll still get a table by the kitchen, and they'll say, look at this loser, he doesn't even have an escort. And I look up there, and I see this place that I'd crashed several times. It's a Sheraton Hotel. And it was like a huge phallic symbol just jutting up there, beckoning me, and a solution came to me, and I said, I'll just wheel off in there, check in, and I'll order up some room service, have a steak, kick back. I'm a little tired anyway. I'll watch a little color TV, and first thing in the morning, I'll go over and get Sky, and we'll go do something. Well, traffic's starting to build now. I finally get to Canal Street, and there are people walking up and down, and it's just, that's a 24-hour city, but it just seemed more exciting than usual. And there's tour buses in the way, and finally I make a right, and I have to go half a block and drive through the motor entrance. And I get it up there, and there's just room to fit this car in, and I'm excited now, and I'm pumped. And the valet parking guy comes over and puts a ticket on it, and I hand him a $20 bill and say, take good care of this car. All that old alcoholic thinking was back. I go in the side door, and it's one of these electric doo-doo doors, you know. I walk in, and there it is, this magnificent lobby laying out in front of me, and the leather couches around Persian rugs and conversational areas and registration desks and back, and they've got a mezzanine, and they have a big Yamaha grand piano, and it's one that plays the disc, and I swear it's Gershwin himself up there playing Rhapsody in Blue. I remember that tune so well. It was Rhapsody in Blue. And to the right is this huge atrium. Goes up about 8 stories, and there's a wraparound bar. And it was the cocktail parties of my youth. I could hear the laughter. I could hear the joy. And I swear I could hear the rattle of cubes in that glass, and it sounded like fine barbarian crystal. And at that instant, at that very instant, I got the significance of the number 49. You see, at that time, the cost of a liter of Jack Daniel's whiskey at all Sheraton International's room service was $49 a bottle. And I realized I was relapsing. I used to ask guys, what's this insistence about there'll come a time when we'll have no defense against the first drink, that we must redouble our spiritual efforts? I said, Sky, what does that mean? He says, ain't you got to pray your butt off? You've got to get in immediate contact with your higher power. That's the only thing that can keep you sober. Now, I'd never prayed in my life. Oh, I was at those meetings, and I'd say the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer, but it didn't mean anything to me. I was muttering words. It wasn't a prayer. I was fitting in, trying to be one of you, but in a very superficial manner. So I said the first prayer I'd ever said in my life. And I always said it was something as elegant as the Serenity Prayer, or something as meaningful as what people refer to as the alcoholic prayer. God help me. But no. This spoiled child threw down the gauntlet to God right in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel. And at the top of my voice, I said, all right, God, if you exist, you'll stop me. People wheeled around and looked at me. And for an instant there, I felt real fear. I knew something as important as me, it'd probably be a cataclysmic event. I figured the ground was going to part and swallow me whole. I'd heard of your Sunday school God, by the way, or a bolt of solid gold lightning would cleave me in two. And what seemed like an interminable length of time and an instant of real fear, nothing happened. And I said, you see, there's nothing to this. I'm relapsing. The yoke of responsibility is gone. I have a twinge that Sky might take it personally. But I hope he would be all right with it. And I strode across that lobby like I owned it. Look out, Charlie's back. I get to the registration area and there's a velvet rope set up in the line. My God, it's 9:10 by now. And I'm waiting and getting impatient. You know, alcoholics have a tendency to do that. And there are three people registering people. And this late, it just seemed strange to me. And finally, it was my turn. And the little girl registering in the middle looked up. I remember her hair was matted on her forehead. She'd obviously pulled a double or something. And she said, next. And I was ready. I walked up and I threw down, not a green, not a gold, but a platinum American Express. And I laid a gold Sheraton Preferred on top of that. And said, I'll have a room on the 42nd floor. See, the 42nd floor is the floor of all suites, and I found this from crashing there in the past. And they have a private bar up there that the next day they can fix you up with the proper medicine, little Bloody Mary or whatever the heart desires, and there's no charge for it. No charge. I'm sure it's figured into the cost of the room, but I always got my money's worth there. And she looked up at me a little puzzle, and she says, sir, do you have reservations? He looked at that computer again. I says, no, but these are my credentials. And she got a very strange look on her face, and she said, uttered a simple sentence. She said simply, there's no room at the inn. And a feeling came over me. I didn't know what to call it. It was a warm feeling. And it was a feeling of total relaxation. It might be what you call serenity. I asked Sky about it, and he said, it's the first time you ever noticed grace. And I found this warmth bubbling up in me, and I looked at her, and I said, you know what? She said, what? I said, there's a higher power, and his name is God. And without hesitation, she reached down and pulled up a house phone and said, "Give me security, I got a live one at the front desk." I grabbed those credit cards and I beat a hasty retreat, and I got there just as they were getting ready to park that car. I said, "You won't believe this, I couldn't get a room, isn't that wonderful?" Guy looked at me, I tossed him another 20, got in that car. I'm here to tell you that was the last alcoholic overt behavior that I'm aware of on my part. I've learned to be just as stingy as the rest of you. That's not true. You're the most generous people I've ever met. You give of something much more valuable than a lousy $20 bill. You give of your time freely. You give of your heart freely. You taught me a valuable lesson, and I'm here to learn from you for the rest of my life. You're the most giving, caring people that I ever choose to associate with, and I hope that you'll accept me on that basis." I got back over. I got to Denny's, and I settled into a booth that they were all there. They were probably on their third drink, a cup of coffee. Coffee's very important to us in New Orleans. And I ordered a cup of coffee, and I just couldn't tell them about this wonderful thing that happened to me. I just savored it. Finally, there came that time when I had to tell Sky. I knew that, boy, what kind of gold star am I going to get for this? Sky said a strange thing. He said, "I wouldn't tell anybody about that if I were you for a while." I said, "Why not, Sky?" And he says, "We've got work to do." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You've got to really work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he says, "You've got to trust me in this." First thing he did was take that Cadillac and donate it to a halfway house for a raffle. And he says, "You don't like GM cars anyway, do you?" I said, "No." He says, "Let's go car shopping." "You ever heard of them?" "A Chevelle?" He bought me a 7-year one that was appropriately rusty. 7 years old, had me buy that. He said, "You've got to promise me you'll drive this for 3 years. I said, "I will." He said, "Give me those credit cards." Gave him every credit card I had, and he neatly cut them in two. He not only sent them back, he sent them with a letter questioning their sanity for extending a no-good-like-me credit in the first place. Boy, that'll do a number on you. And I embarked on this road of happy destiny. Four months later, having worked a real fourth and fifth step in that time, having made my amends the best of my ability, Sky said something strange to me. He said, "Charles, if anything happens to me, you've got to get a sponsor in 24 hours. I said, "Why, Sky? Nothing's going to happen to you." He says, "I know, but if something does..." I said, "Why do I have to get a sponsor in 24 hours? He said, "You can't live without one. You need one." He went to Lafayette that day, and they found him that night. Found him dead. I had a sponsor in 3 hours. So I need a sponsor. I need one today as desperately as I did then. Sky was very active in service and got me into service very early. David A. became my sponsor. And I could identify with David A. because with his ability to memorize the history, David was similar. His nickname used to be Instant Old-Timer. I got active in corrections work. You know, corrections is near and dear to me. That's the first time that it becomes clear to the alcoholic how the non-alcoholic has helped us when Warden Duffy opened up San Quentin to Alcoholics Anonymous and called them specifically to come in and introduce that program. A while back, 2 years ago, I was asked to go to Pennsylvania and talk to prisoners up there in a maximum security prison and some wardens and counselors about what AA is and what AA is not. they're delighted to find out we're self-supporting, you know. That's the good news on their behalf. But I met a person there that was a hostess that met me at the plane. And May the 26th of this year, I married that girl. She's in the program of AA. I married a Yankee. The good news is that she was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and her first name is Georgia. And my life became changed. Scott took me to my first area assembly, and I've rarely missed since. And things just, it made sense. It was, I could get the ashtrays. I could do those things, and I just took such inordinate pleasure in doing things for other people for the first time in my life and not taking credit for it. It just became wonderful. I served every possible role I could in at the local level. I was a chairman of the General Service Board for a couple of years in New Orleans, and I got active at the area level. And then in 1995, I found myself in New York City representing Area 27 on Panel 45 as a delegate to the conference. And what an honor. I wish we could all do that. I met Gay there, and Joycey, and Randy from the great state of Georgia. And it was a wonderful experience. I know after I was staying over to see a trustee friend of mine that had rotated out, and I was going to stay and return home on Tuesday, and everybody leaves on Sunday, and it gets awfully lonely around there, except for still bump into some of the trustees. They have to stay over. They've got important voting to do. And I suddenly said, you know what, I really need a real meeting. And I called Manhattan's central office, and I said to him, I said, I'd like a meeting around at some about 4 o'clock. And they said, you're from out of town? I said, yes, I'm there. So, well, why don't you wait till 7? There's a church around the corner, and they'll have a meeting. And I said, no, there's one down near off of 8, but it's in a bad neighborhood, you can't walk down. And I'm sort of been sitting, I'm getting a little picky now with him. I said, just give me the address down there, the 4 o'clock meeting. He said, well, I finally said, where are you from? And I said, New Orleans. He said, oh, hell, you can walk down there. Got my streetwise pass. But it's been one great adventure after another. No, I've talked too long. Something that happened to me in San Diego, I want to leave you with this. It's just like this. It starts on Thursday evening. It's over on Sunday. And I was staying in a little out of the way, Holiday Inn, two stories high, and we were all wandering around that Sunday afternoon. And people from other countries didn't understand the smoking laws out there, so they were lighting up in the lobby. And finally, the manager had agreed to open a banquet room about this size, and he said, we don't have ashtrays. And I stepped forward, being somewhat of an expert, suggested vegetable pans with sand, and they stocked it. And we found ourselves in that room, and that I was a little put off being so far from the Hyatt and the Marriott, but it turned out to be the ideal place because all the foreign delegations were staying there. And they were all in there smoking and everything, and everybody was bemoaning the fact that it's over, and most people were leaving the next day or some even the day after. So I said, let's have a meeting, and we formed this big circle, and there were about 300 chairs. Everybody sat in this big circle and started sharing, and each shared briefly on what the international had meant to them. And it got to the first person that spoke another language. She was Belgique. She was from Belgium, and she started trying to share a little bit in English, and so on. I said, no, each in their own language. And so she shared in French, and you heard German, and you heard Italian, and you heard Chinese, and you heard Swahili. And you could hear the pain, you could hear the solution. you could almost understand it. And when it got to the Japanese, we were all sitting in a row there. They started sharing, and every now and then I'd hear something that sounded like, sabati, sabati. After it completely ran around the room, we all stood and held hands. And everybody said the serenity prayer in their own language. And I rushed over to the interpreter with the Japanese, and I said, pardon me, I thought I heard the word sobriety. He said, ah, yes, we use your word. We use your word. We don't have a word in Japanese that means that. We decided when we came over we'd use your word. So I asked him the obvious question. I asked him, what does it mean? He looked at me like, well, you dumb son of a gun. I said, how do you interpret it? He said, sobriety. It means sober with peace. Never heard of such a beautiful definition. He says it means sober with peace. And that's the way I'd like to end it this Sunday. I wish you all sober with peace. Thank you.